On today's program, my special guest is Elizabeth Fournier. We're talking about the Green Burial Guidebook, and I'll play an encore presentation of a delightful conversation I had with the great Barbara Sher. I'm Richard Brendan, and the conversations begin now. Hey, welcome to the program. Before we begin those conversations, first, here's a word from two of my sponsors.
Wellness is an active process of becoming more aware and making better choices that move you in the direction of a more successful life. Choices to eat well, move well, and think well enable your body to live well. When your spine is aligned properly, your brain and body are connected. Stillpoint Family Chiropractic is a family wellness center where we focus on your lifestyle and the impact it has on your spine, brain, and your life. Find us on Facebook at Stillpoint Family Chiropractic, or our phone number is 317-863-0365.
This WICR program is underwritten in part by Georgetown Natural Foods Market, located at 4375 Georgetown Road on Indy's west side. They carry organic produce and bulk body care products such as shampoo, lotion, soaps, and shower gel. Their kitchen serves soup, sandwiches, hot entrees, and carryout food. Plus, they have a juice bar. Georgetown Natural Foods Market, located at 4375 Georgetown Road on Indy's west side. Their website is georgetownmarket.com.
Recently, I read a great book. It's called The Green Burial Guidebook, Everything You Need to Plan an Affordable, Environmentally Friendly Burial. You know, funeral expenses here in the United States average more than $10,000. I couldn't believe it. And every year, conventional funerals bury millions tons of wood and concrete and metals, as well as millions of gallons of carcinogen and embalming fluid. There is a better way, and Elizabeth Fournier, affectionately called the Green Reaper, walks you through it step by step. She provides comprehensive and compassionate guidance, covering everything from green burial planning and home funeral basics to legal guidelines and outside-the-box options such as burials at sea. Fournier points the way to green buried practices that consider both the environmental well-being of the planet and the economic well-being of loved ones. Elizabeth Fournier is the owner and operator of Cornerstone Funeral Services outside of Portland, Oregon. She serves on the advisory board for the Green Burial Council, which sets the standard for green burial in North America. She lives on a farm with her husband, daughter, and a whole lot of goats, and it's a joy to have her join us on the program today. Elizabeth Fournier, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you very much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
You know, as a guy that's had a hospice background, I've been thrilled over the years to see the whole death awareness movement really become a worldwide movement, and people you being on the cutting edge of that.
Thank you. We're really realizing that the conversation around death and dying hasn't been something that's been so free and out there.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of us who are just trying to get the wheels going a little bit to realize it's probably a good conversation to be having.
Yeah, your book is very practical. I can't wait to dig into it. But let's first, for our listeners, share your story. How you got into, as Stephen Jenkinson would say, the death trade.
Oh, yeah. Right. Right. Others say the death arts. So I guess it really depends.
That sounds better. Okay.
Yes, he's a grief walker, so I get where he's coming from on that. I knew at a really young age this was going to be my calling, and that's because I had a lot of people in my family pass away when I was a young child. Mm. There are people who lived in my home. They all had the same last name. So you can imagine when you go to a little Catholic school that the priest is always coming over to the home. And then you're always having that name announced at school. The nuns are commissioning people for prayers, and we're having the services and all. So, you know, pretty much was aware that something was unique about my life and my life path. And even though I acted like a very traditional kid and did traditional things, I danced in my garage for the neighbors to see and was part of the brownie troop and all that, I still had this little bit of a inkling of having a dresser in my room with the graveyard, and just sort of knew that I still needed to explore some of this stuff.
Yeah.
So it ended up being kind of, I guess, foreboding, and here I am.
Yeah. And when did you launch Cornerstone Funeral Services?
Luckily, I had a man launch it for me, and what I mean by that is I was working for a corporation in the Portland area, and there was a little tiny funeral home made from a repurposed goat barn in the country that had been up and running for about 1 year, and I was told that this man needed somebody to come out and run the place. So fortunately, you know, that's a real, real godsend, because somebody took all the time with the county and the planning and the zoning and the paperwork and all that really non-fun stuff people do when they start a business. I think it's fun to create a name and create a color scheme for your business card. But the groundwork, not so much. So luckily that was put into place, and then I came out, and then from there shaped it into what it is today.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, as I've shared earlier, I'm all about anything that can demystify death, whether it be the death cafes or so many other things that are taking place now in this country. The other piece that I'm passionate about is the environment. You're bringing the two together for a green burial guidebook. So what exactly is a green burial? Because that will be a brand new term for many of our listeners.
Sure. Yeah, thanks for asking. Really happy to explain what that is. So think about your loved one who's passed away, and they are either at home or they're at a funeral home, and decisions need to be made now how we're going to handle that person. A green burial says, hey, let's rethink the idea of having them embalmed and have them preserved with chemicals. And let's rethink placing that embalmed body inside a metal casket or a casket that's made from really fine wood or something that's lacquered or shellacked or glued or has metal. And then let's not take that fancy, fancy box and put that into another box in the ground, which is called a grave liner. Most cemeteries, standard cemeteries, have this thing that people don't see, but it's in the ground, it's either concrete or it's steel, and it protects the cemetery from having any graves collapse or sink or not be like that pristine, beautiful green lawn. Mm. Think if you dig all that space in the ground, you need to fill it with something.
Yeah.
Sometimes just filling it with soil doesn't allow it to be as beautiful as a cemetery wants it to be. So that's another hidden piece there. So let's just get rid of all three of those things, and then we're looking at a natural burial.
Hmm. Can you share a little bit about the history of burials and how it got to the point where it really became an environmentally harmful process?
It really did. It really did. I would say even as recent as about 150 years ago, most people in the United States were taking care of what we call a natural or a green burial, which really are reversible, similar terms. We had our loved one at home.
Mm-hmm.
We either placed them in the yard in a grave space or down at the local churchyard or the local little cemetery, and that's what we did. We kept everybody inside the community. Well, we ended up leaving the community because we had the Civil War happen. And with the Civil War, we had our boys and our sons and our family members go off and fight this battle across different lines and territories. When these boys had died, a lot of the family members said, we want them to come back to our community. We want to bury them into our yards and our churchyards and have a really nice time of reverence. And these are heroes, and we want to make sure that they get back here. So that changed the face of everything, because in order to get those boys here, embalming was created. So with embalming was the advent and the starting of the funeral industry.
Mm-hmm.
With that came funeral homes, and then rather than have your loved one in your front parlor, they were taken off to the funeral parlor. And so that really started the funeral business and the idea of selling goods and services. Cemeteries got on board and said, hey, yeah, we're no longer the little churchyard. We can create these places because people can have choices of where to go. We can offer really nice grave spaces, and we can sell them for different amounts of money. And before you knew it, people were spending all this money for burials and for goods and for services. And not only was that progressing, but the love and the respect for the environment was really regressing.
Hmm. You know, one of the things I love about your book, it's very, very practical. It's easy to read. You've got a lot of tips in there. You literally can walk the person step by step. You also offer what you call Tales from the Grave. And as a history buff also, I find that fascinating. And speaking of embalming, my boyhood hero growing up originally in Springfield, Illinois, was Abraham Lincoln. But you reminded the reader that when Lincoln's body was sent by train, after the assassination back to Springfield, there was brand new embalming methods at that time to keep the president preserved, really. So people wouldn't be gross when they saw him.
Oh, it's a big, that's a really big deal. And in mortuary schools, they often teach that President Abraham Lincoln was the very first embalming. And that's where we really perfected the method of preservation, because this beloved president was not only on the train back home, but he was on different trains that went to different places where he was laid in state, and he was on a bit of a tour, and people were really wanting to see him, so he really needed that good preservation.
Yeah. As I said, this death awareness movement is growing now. It's gratifying to see, which also things like green burials, there's starting to be more books written about that. How is your book, The Green Burial Guidebook, different from the other books that people might come across?
Well, what I've heard from people who have read it are things sort of like you mentioned. Hey, this is really easy to read. It lays everything out. That was really the intention, was for somebody who had no idea what the heck this was to be able to pick this up and not feel like they're being preached to, not feel like they're made to feel bad if they're choosing a different method, but also making it really simple, as if there's something that you've chosen to do for your loved one, you would be able to have this in front of you and step-by-step figure it out. And also be entertained, like you're saying, the tales from the grave, and have some of that historical knowledge, because we do love trivia. We do love facts and figures. I think that just as a society as a whole, we are curious and hungry and want to know where things come from. So my book's different in the sense where it's not so much the anthropology of why we should do this, but it's the how and the what and the where, and really trying to make it practical.
Yeah. How did you get your nickname, the Green Reaper?
It's clever, and I wish that I had made it up, but I didn't. It was given to me. And I really enjoyed that over time. I would be in somebody's backyard, and we'd be preparing a grave space or taking care of a service, and somebody would make some joke about, oh, well, I want to tell my neighbors that the Grim Reaper is here, but since we're standing in the backyard, I guess I should call you the Green Reaper. Or somebody would just accidentally transpose the words grim and green, or little things like that started to kick in. And other people had heard that. Somebody interviewed me once for a magazine article, and they were talking to a family who said that the name they liked to call me, it was kind of a joke in their family and something, and then a neighbor knew it, and so it just went from there. But I like it because it sounds reverent, and it sounds respectful, and I don't have a costume or a cape or something I wear with it, and I don't, pose for pictures of claiming to be this person or this mythical figure. I just merely think of it as me being in nature with their loved one and helping somebody get their loved one back to earth and nature. And I just think of it as really just a warm and cozy name.
Yeah. You share a little bit on the front end about how you got into the mortuary business. How or why did you decide to write this book?
I wrote the book because people kept asking me if I could put all the information I'm giving them in one place.
Right.
I've been advocating for this for years, and I live in a real rural county of Oregon, and my county allows people to be buried in their yards. So I've also told people throughout the years, if you have any questions about natural burial at all, no matter where you live in the United States or Canada, email me, call me, read an article, do something. I'm here to answer whatever you need without you actually having to go into a funeral home and talk to somebody.
Yeah.
Middle of the night, you got a question, shoot it my way. So people would say, gosh, thanks for that. And, I've called you for the third time now. It'd be so great if you had either a website that has all this information, or if you could write a handbook, or you could have a column in a magazine, or if there's some place we could go for it, have all this information. So I started with a Green Burial page on Facebook. And I thought, it's nice to have that, but that's really centered more towards the Pacific Northwest, or really more with Oregon. So I thought I'd go a little bit deeper. So I was really encouraged by others out there who wanted to do this, to have somebody to be a voice for them.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of people that would hope or wish that they could bury their loved ones in the backyard. It's so much more meaningful. And so that brings up the question, and I'm sure this is from state to state, but is green burial legal, or where is green burial legal? You mentioned Oregon.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question because green burial is technically legal in every 50 state of the union.
Mm-hmm.
So with that, it's legal. However, every state has its own statutes and its own regulations and rules. Some states say a blanket comment of the whole entire state, you know, doesn't allow this on any private land.
Yeah.
You need to use a cemetery.
Yeah.
So the beauty of that is every one of these states has at least one cemetery
mm-hmm.
that allows natural burial to happen in their cemeteries. And this is either a place that has been a preserve where it's just land put aside where it's all completely natural burial, or there's many, many standard cemeteries that have either put apart maybe an acre, half an acre just for natural burials, or even have said, we'll go ahead and sell you whatever grave in the whole entire park and we can be natural, which is really neat. And so if that's kind of how that has to work, other states say, well, we'll regulate this county by county.
Mm-hmm.
So I live in a state where it's really by the county, and then the county takes a look at the address and decides if it's rural, what they feel about it. I'm 20 miles away from Portland, Oregon,
mm-hmm.
and Portland is in a different county than I am. That county says, no, in our whole county, you know, I don't care if you own 20 acres, 40 acres, we just are not going to do this here.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the surrounding counties allow it. So it's just a matter of making a phone call to your local planning and zoning board, running your address by them. And the worst they can tell you is no.
Yeah.
Most of them probably will say, I don't know.
Yeah.
And then you just keep calling and asking, and before you know it, here we are.
Well, this book is so valuable because also towards the end of your book, you have a listing of green burial grounds in the whole United States and Canada. I found that very helpful, state by state. People can just look it up.
Thank you. And something neat about that is people keep emailing me and calling me and saying, hey, thank you for doing this, but there's this one here. And, oh, you know what? There's this other little Oddfellow Cemetery, and I know for a fact they're more than happy to have anybody come, and you don't have to have a grave liner. So I'm compiling a list, and there will be a second version at some point, and I will make all of these updates, and it's just so fun to have people call who say, I've never talked to a mortician before, or I've never had the reason to call a funeral home, but I just want you to know that, you know, right down the street from me is this. So it's amazing how, again, it's nothing we talk about constantly on a
yeah.
daily basis,
yeah.
but people are feeling more comfortable with this, and we need to bury people someplace, so why can't we do this without a grave liner? And that just makes it a natural burial pretty automatically, as long as you take care of some of the other variables on your own. That's really the only thing stopping you from a natural burial is, do I have to have a liner
mm-hmm.
around my casket, so the casket
mm-hmm.
or the burial container or the shroud
mm-hmm.
doesn't actually touch the soil?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and that sounds, and it makes sense to me that there will be a green burial guidebook too, because with all the changes taking place and hopefully more and more states in this country opening up and loosening up on the laws so people can feel empowered, for example. And I don't know if we can do this in every state or various states, but when a loved one dies at home, you can take care of that body yourself as a family. You have a whole chapter of how to wash the body and take care of the body. And I think a lot of people don't even know that that's a right that they have.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up. There are only 10 states in the union that say at this point in time that you really need a licensed funeral director to take claim over the body, fill out the paperwork for the death certificate, file it with the county, and some states say you need to have somebody at the funeral home actually do the transportation.
Mm-hmm.
But all those other states, including the state I live in, which is Oregon, clearly says you can act as your own funeral home, and this means you don't even have to call a funeral home.
Yeah.
Now, there's rules, of course. We always want to follow rules, and I can't state strongly enough that you have all of your own rights. However, there are some statutes put in place. If somebody does die at home, especially where I live, and you want to keep your loved one at home, great, but you will ultimately need to find a medical person who is going to sign that death certificate that you hand them. That person will need to be, cremated or buried or embalmed. or, you know, moved out of state, some sort of disposition will need to happen at some point. Mm-hmm. And again, a lot of those things you can do yourself, but legally we don't let people take care of their own embalming.
Yeah.
We legally don't let people take care of their own cremation. So you might be able to take care of some of these steps by yourself, but you also might need to hire professionals for other steps. So again, all that's sort of explained in the book too, as far as do what you can or what you want. And some people have this great idea, they're going to do everything themselves, they're going to keep their loved one at home, have the burial in the backyard, have all these great steps, but sometimes things just happen with mm-hmm. either the weather. Personally, you just can't do it, and that's okay. There's yeah. professionals all over the place to help you, and that's just fine.
Yeah, and one of the professions that seems to be growing is death doulas. More and more people are getting involved in that work.
Yeah, we have these birth midwives, and these are the people who help out during the birth.
Yeah.
Equally, we have something called a death midwife, and the association for these people have now changed the name to its end-of-life doula, mm-hmm. and they're there really to help you and support the family, and they can do so many things and really take the burden off family members, regardless if you're going to take care of everything personally or if you're going to use a funeral home or whatever your plan is, even if you're not going to have a natural burial. Again, these are still wonderful people who have skills to come in. Just like hospice is a wonderful organization that can help, there's many home funeral guides. There's lots of people who really can step in mm-hmm. and help you at your time of need. And again, you don't know these options are out there unless you read the Green Burial Guidebook that I have, or you search around on the internet.
Yes.
Or, you know, there's a lot of wonderful websites. All that information is there at your fingertips on the interwebs 24 hours a day, but people don't necessarily know because they just call the funeral home like everybody else has done for so long.
Yeah. Speaking of funeral homes, we've discussed the environmental benefits of green burials, but now let's talk about all the economic benefits, what you're talking about in your book.
Yeah, there's lots of them. There really is. And in the perfect case scenario would be your loved one passes at home. You can go ahead and have somebody prepare a space in the backyard by hand digging with shovels. You're going to just wrap your loved one in a sheet off the bed. You're going to move them outside, and then you're going to feast on your wonderful herbs and veggies from the garden. So that's zero impact burial. That's also zero cost burial.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you pay for some tea, or you might have had to put some gas maybe in the backhoe or something, but really
yeah.
the reality is
yeah.
to do this just really inexpensive. Families are finding out that you can have a burial in a traditional standard cemetery, a lot of times in a cardboard box
mm-hmm.
or in a shroud, which can be something that you buy off the internet or you make at home or you go to your favorite fabric store and get material. There's hand-woven natural caskets. There's even simple pine boxes. And a lot of those options are much cheaper than the offerings that they have at funeral homes.
Oh, yeah.
You can get, you know, your casket can come from Costco or Walmart, and those aren't necessarily sustainable or environmental, but it's a less expensive choice a lot of times.
Yeah, it's almost sinful, I think, what funeral homes can charge people in terms of caskets. And I always found it humorous, actually. Years ago, when I would go in and visit people and find out that so many of these caskets that are so expensive would have warranties on them. And it's like, well, who's going to dig it up in 30 years to see if it meets its warranty or not? But they jack up the prices, and it doesn't have to be that expensive.
No, and if you go to a funeral home and they're going to show you caskets that seal and have the non-gasketing seals and have the different grades of steel in them, you know, the reality is it doesn't necessarily matter.
This yeah.
is still going to be steel that's put into the earth. It's going to be surrounded by steel, and nothing is really going to biodegrade. It's just sort of there. Things are going to rust. It's just, you know, ultimately, nothing is good for the environment, but ultimately mm-hmm. nobody either could last forever, even if they're embalmed as well.
Absolutely.
So, death and dying, I think the conversation of it is just so hard because we love people.
Mm-hmm.
And we really, when it comes to the end of life, sometimes people think, well, I'll buy them that really expensive casket, or I'll buy that really big headstone, or we'll do a top-of-the-line funeral because that's what they deserve, and
right.
that's the lifestyle they live, and this right. honors them.
Yeah.
Where I think a lot of people nowadays, they recycle and they bring their bottles and cans back to the store. They grow their own herbs and veggies, and they really think about maybe conscientiously what they put inside their bodies. So if you're willing to live a lifestyle of caring about the environment, it's kind of neat if you can actually have a death that cares about the environment, too.
Yeah, and as people are getting more hip about the environment, maybe that's why there's more than 150 green burial sites in America compared with just a handful a decade ago. It sounds like it is becoming more popular.
And growing, right?
Yeah,
just like
yeah.
You talked about, I keep getting calls saying, hey, this little place over here says, you know, nobody ever gets buried there. So sure, why not? You know, a lot of cemeteries will also say that they have a rule that you have to have a liner and or a grave box or whatever they call it. And if you ask them, well, why, they might say, well, it's just our rule. But I think asking nicely sometimes and asking if maybe we don't have to have this rule, a lot of times the board of directors, which is really just two people, or it's somebody who has a rule on the books that really doesn't know why, it says, okay, that's fine. I guess I don't really see any harm of you coming in and doing this, and really it's no harm, and ultimately the grass will get the natural fertilizer and the shrubs and everything else just sort of grows very nice when you have a loved one sick. Or not 6 feet down, like you say, but 4 feet down. We want that 4 feet place because that's really where the biosphere and the fungi and all the bacteria and everything is really able and ready to absorb and do what it needs to do. But you're actually making it to be a much more lovely, lovely burial spot and cemetery.
Yeah. Well, I'm definitely in. So if I want to have a green burial for my own passing, and I do, how do I set that up so that my family will respect my wishes? I want to make it as easy as possible for them.
I love that you ask that because this is a very, very important thing. A lot of times with natural burial, the idea of pre-planning or pre-discussion is very important. First off, you have to explain to the person who's making the decision for you, so either a spouse, adult child, or whomever you specify, that you want to do this and your reasons for doing this. That's very important. Then I think the next step would be to figure it out, where do you want to be laid to rest? Because if you can't do this in your yard or don't want to do it in your yard, there's several people who have property who say that's not what I want to do, and that's fine. Then you'll need to figure out locally, where are you going to do that in your county, in your city? Or do you want to go elsewhere? Figure out where is your resting place going to be. Some people actually secure the grave space. They go, they talk to the people, they pick it out, they pay for it. But just having an idea where you can do this. And from there, you're pretty well set. You might also want to think about what container you're going to be in, because, again, that helps your loved ones know, oh, he wants a simple pine box, and there's that carpenter down the street. Or, you know what, there's this website here that has these eco sort of grass-woven wicker caskets, and he always wanted one of those. And so, again, just helping somebody through this. And in the book, I mention if you have any plans for your funeral or your burial, put it in a brightly covered notebook and let people know this is it. On the same token, just quickly to tell people, don't be too crazy in your plans, because I have a lot of families who come to me and they're so upset because this person really wanted to be sprinkled at the Taj Mahal and the family can't afford plane tickets to get there and they have these ashes. So I'm finding that too. It's great to let people know what you want, but also consider their budgets and their time frames and just their own sense of mind too.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Yes, thank you. It eases the guilt of people who can't afford to go to the Taj Mahal and do that. As one who has officiated a lot of funerals over the years, I'm curious, Elizabeth, can you share a green burial ceremony that you facilitated that you found truly inspirational?
Oh, gosh, there's so many of them. One was a Native American man, and we made a medicine circle with the rocks, and we talked to the all four directions of the wind and just the way the drums were beating and how I really felt like I was a part of something bigger than just us people standing there, just the energy and the sacredness of the service was pretty moving. I've been to people's homes where we've fished down the street by the river, and that river was brought up the banks, and the food was eaten. Another neat one I went to recently was a man who was in a eco casket, which was painted. It was more of a pod, and it was painted like a yellow submarine. He was buried at the banks of the river, and his idea is when the big earthquake comes or when the you know, the fault line breaks or something, he will just careen down the hill and go down the river in his yellow submarine. So the creativity of people is just amazing.
I love that. So finally, what are some first steps and best advice you can give to a family who perhaps have just lost a loved one and are thinking about doing a green burial?
Well, first, and check in with yourself. And it's really about your new life, as far as you have to figure out what your new normal is, because that person is no longer in your life. Okay, so that's the hard thing. You know, you need to drink your water, and you need to just know that whatever you choose will be okay. If you're going to look for the green burial, again, the first thing I think about is find out, work backwards in a sense, figure out where the resting place will be, and then work backward from there.
Yeah.
And that's really important. Where will they be laid to rest? And then do you want to do all this yourself, or do you want to have a funeral home involved?
Absolutely. My guest has been Elizabeth Fournier. The book is The Green Burial Guidebook, Everything You Need to Plan an Affordable, Environmentally Friendly Burial. This is a great book. I really highly recommend this to anyone who's listening. And if you have an interest at all in green burial, this is a book to purchase, The Green Burial Guidebook. Elizabeth, can you share your web address, please?
Yes, sure. My funeral home is cornerstonefuneral.com. Mm-hmm. There's mm-hmm. lots of information there. And then my website for the book is thegreenreaper.org.
All right, thegreenreaper.org. Elizabeth, thank you so much for sharing your time with us today.
Thank you so kindly.
I love that website. Once again, it is thegreenreaper.org. We're going to have another word from our sponsors and our newest Wellness Minute from Dr. Mary Grace Pinella. And then right after that, we're going to get into that delightful conversation I had with Barbara Sher. She wrote the best-selling book, Wishcraft. This conversation is on It's Only Too Late If You Don't Start Now.
Goddess Mountain Naturals crafts quality salves and balms intended to aid in healing and rejuvenation of the skin and body through properties provided by nature. The various salves help to moisturize your skin, soothe itching caused by bug bites and poison ivy. These salves have been found to ease pain from sore muscles and tendons and aid in the healing of cuts and scrapes. These are remedies that have been used for thousands of years. For more information, you can visit www.goddessmountain.com. That's goddessmountain.com.
Richard Brendan, Bringing Love to Life, is underwritten in part by Natural Awakenings magazine. Each month, Natural Awakenings takes a practical look at the latest natural approaches to nutrition, fitness, creative expression, personal growth, and sustainable living. The magazine also covers the products and services that support a healthy lifestyle. Natural Awakenings magazine is a free publication and can be found at most healthy lifestyle outlets. Their website is awakenindy.com.
It's that time of year. Time to do your homework on which is the safest sunscreen product for you and your family. Please note, I'm not talking about safety from the sun, but safety from the chemicals found in most commercial sunscreens. Sunshine is not the enemy. If you are vitamin F deficient, however, it can be dangerous. Vitamin F takes calcium from your blood and puts it into your tissues. Tissue calcium deficiency is the source of that tough, thick skin we see in sun worshippers. It can also set you up for sunstroke or worse. Vitamin F is known as polyunsaturated fatty acids. The fatty acid your body can use comes from fatty meat and butter. To use the calcium you get from the sun, you must have adequate vitamin F reserves. So one option is increase your intake of clean fatty meats and butter, a yummy choice, or you can supplement with vitamin F. In fact, a great skin-protecting formula for these sunny days is Cataplex F and calcium lactate from Standard Process. You can find both of these products at Still Point Family Chiropractic.
Barbara Sher, welcome to Journeys Fire.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. I've enjoyed your books over the years, and especially your latest. And it really goes along with the PBS special that's been playing across the country, Creating Your Second Life After 40. Your newest book is It's Only Too Late If You Don't Start Now. Really addresses a lot of fears that I think people are going through, especially in midlife.
Yeah, you know, the second half is how to create your second life after 40.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that got me to write that book was the fact that I got much older than 40, and all the terrible things I expected to happen, not only did they not happen, but good stuff happened. And I mm-hmm. thought, how come nobody told me this?
Yeah.
You know, because I had looked at other books about midlife, but they were all, you know, they were all physical. You know, this isn't going to work, and that is going to work. And I thought, that's not what I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about why did I think that once I was over 40 or even 50 that it was all over, the party was over, and things were just going to get worse till I was dead? You know, why did I think that? I didn't. My mother didn't even live that way. They had a great life after 40 and 50. What on earth is going on here? And the more I explored it, the more I realized that there is, I came up with what I call a conspiracy theory. And believe it or not, the conspiracy theory isn't Madison Avenue or advertising. It's, I mean, they follow along, certainly. The conspiracy is actually biological. There's something inside of us that is trained to think at a certain age that the party's going to be over, and to make us desperate, so that we will go out and make maybe reproduce one more time. I swear it's programmed into us.
Yeah, and if we're not aware of it and don't question it, we do buy into that, don't we?
Everybody does. I mean, I always think the saddest years are the years between 40 and, like, 55.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you hit 40, I mean, there are people who have parties with black balloons.
That's right? What I was thinking of, exactly.
Yeah, and they say it's all over. And then everybody starts working on the project of staying young, trying to hide the fact that they're over the hill and they're old and they're ugly and it's all over, right? And like they start working so hard, both psychologically and physically, and, you know, spending big money on all kinds of exercise things and surgery, as well as, you know, the famous red cars, you know, the sort of midlife crisis stuff. And they, you know, and by about 52, they're like desperate. And then it seems to happen somehow with women earlier than men. And that's for biological reasons, too. Around 55 or 56, women just give up. And all of a sudden, they figure out, like, wait a minute. I never felt so good in my life. Once I quit playing the popularity contest and take my life back for myself instead of trying to win hearts, like I've been doing since I hit puberty,
yeah.
All of a sudden, it's a different game. It's a wonderful place to be. And men are a little slower because biologically their hormones slow down later.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, men can really lose a lot more time trying to keep up, you know, trying to look young, trying to, you know, still beat everybody on the basketball court, trying to still be hot stuff.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and that's when men, you know, will leave a wife they love and try to get a trophy wife just to show they still got the stuff. You know, it's built into your hormones. And you don't have to, you can't change the way you feel, but if you understand it, it changes everything. You know, I often said to people, if you think you're having a heart attack, you know, that's one thing. But if the same pain turns out it's just nothing but a gas pain, it just hurts just as much, but it's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah. So you put in your book, don't panic, it's only a midlife crisis.
That's all it is. And when you pass through it to the other side, my God, it is so excellent.
But
and I just am trying to save people that 15 years, you know.
Oh, exactly.
You know.
It's amazing that what we think about, because I'm in my late 40s, I have silver hair. Three different times I've gone into McDonald's to get a cup of coffee, and they've given me the senior citizen discount. And I never know how to react. And I'm hip to the kind of things we're talking about, but it hits me. It's like, I'm getting older.
I know, and because there's always us and them about you and seniors. And seniors sounds like a kind of world that you didn't ever want to have to visit. And, you know, it ain't us and them. It's like, well, actually, in my TV special, public television special, I always say it's you don't want to be young. Being young is really pretty unfortunate. <It's> like, nobody understands how good you usually feel at 50 and 60. You know, people, I've even read articles where they worry about 60-year-olds not getting ready for their 70s and 80s because they feel so good. They don't believe they're ever going to stop feeling young because it's such a big surprise to not be broken down and decrepit by the time you're 48. And, you know, I mean, nobody ever was, incidentally. This is not just because we're living longer. In my mother's day, my mother's 91. She just stopped driving about 2 months ago. You know, people really never did get, that was all in the movies. Remember the Little Rascals where the dear fat old granny was rocking in the rocking chair?
Yes.
She was probably about 56. and even in those days, grannies didn't look that way. You know, a lot of them were working, and they had, I mean, the working classes, the poorer people, they were all working. The upper classes, and you know, those, you know, long, long time ago before the World War II, the upper classes, the women never worked. I mean, they were totally miserable, bored. But the working classes, they never sat in rocking chairs and got old and fat. That was strictly an invention of, you know, kind of a sentimental invention of Hollywood.
Ever since I read your first book years ago, Wishcraft, I've always kind of referred to you to my friends as the Go For Your Dreams lady. And, and you really have inspired people to do that through all of your books. And why I like this is because you're telling everybody, you know, it's never too late to go for your dreams.
I think probably in this latest book I go further than that and say that you can really not entirely go for your dreams until you drop that game nature had you hooked into.
Oh, yeah.
Because you were kind of nature's servant from the time you first hit puberty until the time your hormones die down. You're really kind of a slave of nature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think it's you who, you know, and it might as well be, you know, you who wants to get married to the right person, have the babies that are the most beautiful ones on the block and be the most successful. And, you know, this kind of drive and energy, you know, the species needs it. You're supposed to do it. It's good for you. But what you don't realize is that that keeps you too busy to just sit back and say, what is it I love? What's the best way to use my life? Because who has the luxury? Those are the workhorse years, you know, from the time you're 15 and looking to get in the right school or get the right mate or get the, you know, be the hottest guy on the basketball court, until the time you're about 55. You really are working. You're hooked up. You're like a real draft horse. And it isn't until after that, until all the competition has kind of left you, and you're sitting there thinking, well, if I don't have to compete, and if I don't have to look good, and if I'm not trying to win a popularity contest, and if I'm not looking for points, what do I really want? And what helps us think that way is that for some reason, at the age of 40, right around the age of 40, everybody suddenly gets it that they are mortal and they're not going to live forever. I mean, when you're an adolescent, you write poetry in your 20s, but you really, somehow it's premature because by the time you're 55 or 60, you really don't care anymore. You don't believe it anymore. But at 40, suddenly it hits you, my God, I could run out of time.
Yeah.
Like you run out of milk or sugar.
Yeah.
And that's a kind of a fortunate thing because that's when people get the first jolt of, what about me? What about what I wanted out of this one life?
Mm-hmm.
Now that I get it, that it's not forever, it's like, how do you live now that you know you're not going to live forever? And as I say, it sounds very gloomy, except by the time you're 50, you don't even think about it. I mean, by the time you're 60, you think, not live forever? Of course I'm going to live forever.
Yeah.
But at 40, suddenly you feel mortal. And that's when people begin the search. But they're so torn apart. You know, that's the age, I think, at which nature says to women, at least, you know, pretty soon I'm not going to be able to get a baby out of this lady. Let me see if I can make her crazy again like an adolescent. You know, get one more. And so that's, you know, you really are fighting this fear. You know, the only complaints I've ever gotten about my book, and I've seen them on Amazon.com, not personally, is most people love the book, and it's an unusual book. It's a good book. I'm very proud of it, and it's good to read, and it's, you know, it's a real eye-opener. It's exciting.
Yes.
It's an exciting book, I think. But the only complaints I get are from women who are enraged that I say that at a certain age you stop being sexually attractive. And they say, well, she must be some ugly dog, this woman, to say everybody gets ugly when they get old. And, of course, I didn't say anything of the sort. What I said was that it doesn't, you can be the most beautiful 90-year-old, 80-year-old, or 70-year-old in the world. But when somebody who wants to mate starts whistling at females, they don't whistle at females who don't look fertile. They don't even know they're doing it, but that's what it's about. It's not about beauty.
Right.
It's about fertility, and it's totally biological. And if they whistled at women who were infertile, the species would have disappeared a long time ago.
I was a realization of that when I noticed that women were starting to look at my son more than me.
It happens to men, too. Women think it doesn't, but it does.
Oh, yeah.
It happens to men, exactly. And you keep thinking, wow, I could be the best-looking guy in the world, but my son looks juicier. That's just all there is to it. You can't. When it comes to reproduction, you cannot compete with somebody who is 20 times more fertile than you are.
Well,
but
yeah.
You don't think of it that way. You know, women say, well, I don't intend to get ugly and old, like she says. A few women, really, I was so shocked, because of all the things I said in that book you could take issue with, you know, that's the only one that gets anybody angry, is don't tell me I'm not going to be beautiful. That's how hard it is to really get over that contest, the desperation of that contest that nature plunges us. You know, when you're 6 years old, you really don't care how you look, man. You just don't even want to take a bath. You know, you want to play, and you don't want to talk about how you look. And, you know, by the time you hit adolescence, all you care about is how you look. And that's nature. That's nature's mischief, as far as I'm concerned. But the thing is, it's traumatic, I think, because it's very hard to get over. Even my mother at 91 looks in the mirror and she says, I'm so wrinkled. I said, Ma, it's time to be wrinkled, Ma. You know,
it's quite 91. Natural at 91.
Yeah, you're 91. It's time to be wrinkled. Oh, I didn't used to look like this. I said, yeah, consider the alternatives. You know, I mean, there comes a point in your life, and this is what's so wonderful about it. It sounds like a loss, and it isn't. It's an incredible gain. There comes a period in your life when you stop worrying about how you look to others, and you start to see. All you care about is what you see, not how you look. Now, think of the hugeness of that difference. You're walking along saying, my stomach is in, do I look good in this dress, do I look good in this suit, what do people think of me? And you don't even realize that makes you a slave. If you're a real beauty, you're a bigger slave than if you're not one. Because if you're not a beauty, you tend to be invisible and you can have your own life. But at that age, you don't like that. But when you get older, you think, you know what, I am just never going to look like a model. I guess I'm going to have to face that. And you forget how you look. And then your eyes open. And when your eyes open, all of a sudden this world presents itself to you. You see people you never saw before. You see colors. You start thinking, what makes me happy? I think I'll do it. I think I'll try it. And the world is sort of presented. You don't even realize you were kind of like a deer in the headlights before that, by comparison. Suddenly everything gets visible. And that's why old people look so happy. They sit there smiling, and, you know, younger people think, what do they got to be happy about? Truth is, the older people are the ones whose eyes are smiling, not the younger people. They're the ones who look worried.
I'm speaking with best-selling author and counselor Barbara Sher about her newest book, It's Only Too Late If You Don't Start Now. You're listening to Journey's Fire. We'll be right back after a short break. Barbara, we were talking about the illusion, if you will, of beauty. You talk about several illusions in your book that we've bought into, and another illusion, and you addressed it a little bit earlier, and that's time limits.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't realize that knowing that we have a limited amount of time, which is impossible to understand until you hit about 40 for some reason. I mean, that's nature, too. Nature wants us to be reckless. Up until the age that we're old enough to have babies, then it wants us to be more conservative. I mean, I'm speculating, but it seems to work that way with every species, every mammal species, and it certainly works that way with us. So that the young men are willing to go out and fight for mates, or fight in the war, or be reckless, and the young women are doing whatever the species determines, and then at a certain age you quiet down. But it's when you quiet down that you understand that your time is not unlimited. And then, you know, that can be a source of great grieving. Oh, my God, I just figured out I'm probably going to die. I thought other people were going to die, not me. And I feel like saying, you know, when I say to people, yeah, you probably got 50, 60 years, you know, to kill. I'd pace myself if I were you. It's not going to happen. Don't run up your credit cards. You know, you might not die that soon. But, you know, that's when people say, I don't care how far away it is. It's like, I mean, it really is a shocker. But then something fantastic happens. It's like if you have an endless amount of money, you spend it on anything. You buy everything. You don't even, you know, I know some super rich people who bought a big farm upstate New York. Some friends of mine were the caretakers. These are very, very famous people. They only visited it once. You know, when you have too much money, money doesn't count for much.
Mm-hmm.
But when you've got, you know, you're walking around with 10 bucks, and you've got to make sure that 10 bucks gets you what you need. You spend it really carefully. You take a look at what you want. You know, you pay attention to what you get. And when you understand that your time is not unlimited, that's the greatest gift in the world, because there's an age at which the fear, and there is a fear, the fear of being everything you can be,
yeah,
that suddenly gets smaller. I mean, it's the biggest thing in the world, and it stops you from doing things. All of a sudden, the fear of not being everything you can be
mm-hmm.
gets bigger. So the only thing that gets rid of your fear of, like, jumping out there and doing what you want is the fear that you might not get a chance to do that if you don't get in gear.
Yes.
And I always say, like I say, the subtitle is, the title of the book is It's Only Too Late If You Don't Start Now, meaning it isn't too late, it's never too late, but it will be if you don't get into gear now, tonight. So that if you say, oh, someday I'd like to be a writer, you pick up a pencil and paper before you go to sleep tonight, and you write four lines tonight. And if you think that's nothing, it's the difference between standing on the shore and getting in the water. The difference is total.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter whether you swim the channel or not. You just get wet, and everything's different.
And it's so, becoming more awake and aware of the surroundings.
Well, when you know that you can't have everything forever.
Yes.
I have people do an exercise. I say, you know, even if you're riding a bus, you know, some stranger, take a look at the bus driver and pretend you got this message that he's not going to live more than 24 hours, that you've got this secret message like in a movie or something. And then look at the bus driver again, and all of a sudden he becomes a very precious human being. It's amazing. Like, even though it's just a fantasy, a pretend thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, what if I knew in advance when people were going to die? What if I knew that bus driver was going to die, some stranger? All of a sudden, you look at them and you get it. Meaning that when you understand that time is not endless, and even if you're going to live another 100 years, today will never be back again. You know, if you're sitting with your child or your grandchild or your dog or a beautiful plant that you like, right? This moment you're in is never coming back, even... You know, we're not just talking about death. We're talking about facing the fact that you can't squander time anymore. The moment that you're in, you know, take a look. Just think every once in a while. You can't live like this, but you can think every once in a while, this isn't coming back. No matter how good my life gets, this moment isn't coming back. Let me make sure I'm paying attention.
And truly seeing that bus driver is really what love is all about.
You couldn't say it better, because love is about really seeing. It's not about being seen. It's not about being adored. It's not about owning something. It's not about changing something. It's about being able to see it with everything that's in you. And that is love. That's how I define love. You know, I mean, there's responsibility and taking care of it. That's a very important aspect, you know, of love. But the feeling of love means you're just looking at something and nothing is between you
mm-hmm.
and actually seeing it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can feel that way about a beautiful day. You can feel that way about your dog. You know, love is love. It's all vitamins for the soul.
You have a wonderful chapter in your book called Escape to Freedom.
Yeah, running away from home.
Yes, yes, and having that barbarian awe from one of the quotes you had in the book. Talk
yeah.
about that, and talk about that drive that we seem to have deep inside us and what that's really all about.
Well, I think that what happens is that at at a certain age, you panic and you want to run away from home, like, and start over. You know, it's like the Mosquito Coast syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to happen more in men, actually, than women. But there's a version of it that happens in women, too. And it's like this big adventure. I want to burn everything down that I've ever known before and start over, preferably on a desert island. You know, something on a pirate ship or, you know. Who's that great comic? What is his name? Dave Barry. He said in one of his books, he said women, men should do important things, and women should like be president, run the world, run the Wall Street, you know, be in charge of the environment. Men should be pirates.
That's right. Or cowboys.
Or cowboys. So, but basically the impulse, I mean, and that's, you know, that's just a terrible fear of growing old and having, you know, moss grow over you before you're, you know, while you're still walking around. That means that you've allowed, and everybody does, you can't help this, you've allowed your life to get old and you have to get new again.
Mm.
It doesn't mean you have to, Marcel Proust said that a new world doesn't mean you have to go to a new place, it means you have to get new eyes.
Yeah, because you talk about how it's longing to feel the child's sense of wonder
again. Exactly. And you can feel what's happened is you've been this workhorse for decades, and you've always been afraid from the time you first got a job or first had a baby. You're always afraid you're not going to do it right. And so you're like constantly on, you know, trying to stay ahead of the danger and organize things. And after decades of that, you can no longer remember what it was like when you were a kid and you didn't have to do anything except see everything and, you know, taste everything, feel everything, you know, climb everywhere, go under things. And you don't remember that anymore, and you don't know what's missing, but that's what's missing, you know, that freshness. And what you don't realize, I always say that, you know, they say that you grow up and you have to lay down your toys, but what they forget to tell you is you get to pick them up again. And there's an age at which you wise up and you get conscious. You come out of that hysterical dream of, you know, desperation and achievement, and suddenly you sit back and you say, I don't want to do that anymore. And if I don't have to, I'm not going to.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just sort of sit back and look around, and that starts coming back, that child sense of wonder, because you're not, you know. It's like if you're in a war and there are bullets going by you, you don't say, what a nice sunset.
Yeah.
You can't. You know, you're on a totally different mode of operation. But when the war is over, you should be allowed to sit there and say, wow, look at that sunset. That's when you can do it again. And the, you know, the high hormone years are like being in a kind of war. You know, I mean, you really have high stakes, and you're really, if you're not a winner, you're going to be a loser. You know, everything just seems very desperate. And then when you get older, and I, you know, it starts happening when you're 40. It doesn't complete it. I don't know when it completes itself. I don't think the beauty thing ever goes. But the other things start really, you know, winding down, if you will let them, in your early 50s and late 50s. And, I mean, they did a study that said that women of 57 were off the charts in happiness.
Yeah.
They're the happiest single group of people in the country, women over 57, or of 57, I guess. And then what happens is you just wake up. Sometimes people have grandchildren, and they get on the floor with their grandchildren, and that's how they wake up.
They wake up, and like you say in your book, they finally have the courage to truly live their life.
Yeah, exactly, and it takes some courage, and you need to be afraid that you're not going to live forever to have the guts to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I mentioned in that book, a friend of mine told me his uncle, who'd worked in the garment industry for years, he was about 57, and he had retired a little early, I guess, and he was on the floor with his grandchild. They were playing with a Play-Doh. It was the first time he'd ever touched the stuff. He was playing with it, and he just mushing in his hands for the first time. He went and took an art class, and 6 years later, when I was talking to this friend, he was in Paris. He had an atelier, a sculpture studio, and was selling his sculptures. He never had laid a finger on anything like that before. He had a gift for it that he had simply never known about.
Awesome.
So what happens is, if you let yourself slow down and get out of the race and stop being desperate about, you know, are you the highest earner? Do you have the biggest house? Do you look the best? Do your kids look the best? Is everything, you know, if you get away from that craziness and slow down, and you start to let your barbarian awe come back. I mean, you don't have to go to the Mosquito Coast. You can lie on your back in your backyard on the grass and look at the sky for a full hour.
We've been getting our barbarian awe on with Barbara Scher. I want to thank my special guest today, Elizabeth Foynet, for her book, also the Green Burial Guidebook, and always thanking you for joining us each Sunday and also throughout the week, because we do podcast this on richardbrendan.org. And so for engineer Aaron Duvall and production coordinator Angel Richardson, I'm Richard Brendan. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.